Vast new tracts of the internet are up for sale as of today. Forget .com or .org. For a registration fee of $185,000, you too can apply to register a new suffix like .travel or .music, or maybe a brand name. .npr. The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, known as ICANN, plans to sell new domain categories despite opposition from regulators and advertisers, NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
If you think of the Internet as virtual land, new continents are now on the block. Currently, there are 22 generic domains like .net or .gov. Under this new program, as many as 1,000 new ones could come to market every year. Applicants must qualify and pass ICANN's various criminal and other background checks. Rod Beckstrom is CEO of ICANN.
We're not sure what percentage of the applications will be successful because that will depend on the qualifications of the applications, and we haven't seen them yet. But I would suspect a pretty high ratio of successful applications.
Beckstrom says this move will make the web more global, allowing, for example, other cultures and countries to use non-Roman character systems in the suffix.
They should have that right, and who are we to tell them, no, you don't have the right to have Chinese characters in top-level domains.
In May, ICANN will publish a list of all the proposed domains. One can imagine .food or .hotels making that list, although, for example, .nabisco or .marriott could also appear. Opponents will get 60 days to file objections. As for finding your way around the new and expanded internet, Beckstrom says he doesn't expect this to add to the complexity.
If you're able to go directly to the company name, .company name or .brand, then you will know that you're at that site. So there's actually an argument that in some ways this new program could add more clarity, more quality, and security to certain aspects of the internet.
Beckstrom says ICANN deliberated this move for 6 years and will take steps to protect brand names. Besides, he says there is demand for these new domains.
My sense is that a lot of this demand is just absolutely artificial and, you know, largely imagined by the ICANN board.
That is the dissenting voice of John Leibovitz, the chairman of the Federal Trade Commission.
We're an agency that's required to protect consumers, and from our perspective, this is a potential disaster, and we have an obligation, we feel, to speak out.
Last month, the FTC sent ICANN a long letter detailing its concerns, including the potential for an exponential increase in phishing and other fraudulent web-based scams. But as a non-governmental global nonprofit, ICANN does not fall under the legal jurisdiction of the FTC or any other government agency. Leibovitz says he is not assured by ICANN's pledge to self-police or its promises to protect companies from brand infringement. The group's existing database of website owners, Leibovitz says, already poses problems to law enforcement.
Websites registered to God, to Mickey Mouse, to Bill Clinton. And of course, if you're a scammer, if you're in the business of ripping off consumers, why would you give accurate information?
Douglas Wood is general counsel of the Association of National Advertisers. He says if the launch of the .XXX domain last year is any guide, companies will be forced to spend more money buying sites defensively, just so no one else uses them.
All that money is just wasted money because it's money thrown away to property rights that will never be used, never add to competition, never add to innovation, never do any of the things that ICANN is touting will be the great benefits of all these new top-level domains.
Wood says companies will have little recourse but to sue, but ICANN won't be able to undo the damage.
How are they going to compensate all the brands and the consumers who have been harmed because they went pell-mell into a new system that had controls that didn't in fact work?
For now, ICANN is just taking applications. The first of these new domain names are expected to pop up in browsers early next year. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Most of us think of YouTube as a place where you spend a few minutes, get a few laughs, and encounter the unexpected.
Mishka, I love you. Mishka, I love you. Mishka, I love you.
I love you. I love you.
I love you.
Good girl.
I love you.
I love you. Good girl. Good girl. you.
Memorable. But YouTube may be changing, and in a big way. These days, our internet watching experiences are very different from our TV viewing. We'll enjoy short, grainy videos on computers, but spend hours in the living room with the TV set. As technology changes in coming years, though, TV sets will offer internet content just as easily as cable or broadcast TV. And internet content providers like YouTube can compete for big audiences and big advertising dollars. So YouTube, which is owned by Google, is preparing to launch dozens of professionally produced channels with specialized content they hope will appeal to millions of people. John Seabrook writes about YouTube's ambitious plans in the current issue of The New Yorker. John Seabrook is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest book is Flash of Genius and Other True Stories of Invention. Well, John Seabrook, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Dave.
You know, a long time ago, there were, you know, the three major networks which could produce television, which got a huge national audience. And then cable came along and fragmented, you know, the TV viewing audience. And we also saw, you know, more narrowly focused channels, food channels, a history channel, shopping channels, you know, fishing channels. Does YouTube think there's a market for even narrower niches?
Yes, they definitely do. I mean, they see the Asian channel, for example, which there doesn't really exist on cable, or an Asian sitcom, or a transgender channel, or a, well, a cricket channel, or a horseback riding channel. There are a lot of sports and pastimes that have a large group of people interested in them, but they're not necessarily based in one country. And one of the unique things about YouTube is that it's global, so you can put together an audience of cricket lovers from many countries around the world and achieve a pretty large audience. But if you just tried to do that in one country, you'd get a fairly small audience. So YouTube allows you to kind of aggregate these disparate audiences in various countries and put them together into one pretty good-sized chunk.
Right. And they're going to be, you know, commissioning, you know, professional performers or content developers to make stuff for them. Who are they asking to produce channels?
Well, you know, over the last year, they've held kind of a sweepstakes. The word went out. It was an open secret. YouTube wouldn't confirm it officially, but a lot of people got approached by YouTube in many different media, print, TV, movies, music, dance. And YouTube offered kind of book publishing style advances of several million dollars to people who were professional content creators who were willing to make content for one of these new YouTube channels. And they got something like 1,000 people who submitted proposals for channels. And then they winnowed it down to about 100. A lot of them are people you know. I mean, Madonna's doing a dance-oriented channel. Shaquille O'Neal is doing a kind of, I don't know, Shaq kind of comedy channel. There's some writers of well-known TV shows. For example, Anthony Zecker, who created CSI for CBS, is doing a sort of night gallery-like show. Amy Poehler is doing a channel. So there are quite a few sort of celebrities from the old world that we already know. And then there are some of these YouTube partners, sort of homegrown stars, like Michelle Phan, who has a very popular beauty tips channel, who have gotten one of these advances in order to sort of, you know, have the money to create bigger production values and more elaborate scenarios.
Now, in terms of advertising, we're used to seeing TV peppered with like 30 and 60 second ads on the compute. YouTube, we're used to pop-up ads. What kind of advertising will appear on YouTube channels, or is that clear yet?
Well, it's not really clear yet. I mean, YouTube would love to get, you know, 30-second or 60-second long ads that people would watch. I mean, the big difference is, I think, that you're going to always have the option to click away from the ad on YouTube after a certain amount of time. And there, the proposition to the advertisers is, well, yes, it's true that we're not forcing people to watch your ads the way we are on television, but when people don't click away, you know that those people are very motivated, you know, potential customers. Also, we know their information. Because this is all delivered over the internet, you know a lot more about the people who are watching your ads than you do about the people who are watching your ads on television.
you know, you tend to know their history on YouTube, at least. You might know some of their social friends, particularly if they are linking their YouTube stuff to Facebook. And then you can get into their purchase histories and stuff like that. So there's potentially a lot more information and potentially a much more sort of motivated audience. But you do have to get people to watch the ads. And that actually might not be a bad thing either, because it might force people who make ads to really make a great ad, an ad that you just really want to watch. And particularly the first 10 seconds of that ad, which is that part that you're going to watch before you have a chance to click away, if you can make something really super compelling, you know, that's a win for everyone, because, you know, you get an ad that you like to watch and the advertiser gets you. In fact, the most viral of all videos, the quickest video to a million views on YouTube is the Old Spice. It's an ad. It's that guy, that Old Spice guy, doing his thing. And I think this is another thing when we look forward. I think the distinction between advertising and programming is probably going to get a little blurrier in the YouTube future.
Right. And of course, the fact that advertisers can get all this data about the individuals that are viewing their stuff, as you said, I mean, maybe even who some of their social relationships are, what their viewing habits are, is kind of creepy to some people.
It is kind of creepy. But, you know, it's kind of creepy when you write an email and Google has got ads that are keying on words that you put in your email right next to, you know, your personal email. But, you know, you get used to it and you're willing to make these trade-offs. You get Gmail for free and it's supported by ads. And, you know, you say to yourself, well, you know, hopefully Google is not going to misuse this information. That's the big question. And so you go with it.
I wonder if there's a risk that sort of the essence and appeal of YouTube, I mean, you know, the serendipity of finding a hilarious moment or a unique voice, you know, would be undermined by this whole new direction.
It's a good question. And it's true that one of the pleasures of YouTube, two of the pleasures of YouTube have been, A, the sort of anarchic nature of it, which, you know, in the early days just seemed so great that, you know, you could have this totally unplanned, you know, no one was in charge type feeling. So different from television. And then the other aspect of it was, as you said, the serendipity, the things that you would just stumble upon. And I think as these new channels come in and start getting popular, it's probably going to be less likely that you're going to stumble upon things that are totally out of left field, because, you know, that's just the way that the site is going to be reoriented toward, you know, the hit makers and away from, you know, the random people. They'll still be there, but it's, I think, going to be less easy to find than it has been. And that would be kind of a loss.
Do you have a favorite channel, a favorite performer of yours?
Yeah, I love the Gregory Brothers. I think they're musically really talented. They're great musicians. It's three siblings and the wife of one of the siblings.
Just explain what it is the Gregory Brothers do.
The Gregory Brothers are looking around, and actually what happens now is a lot of people send the Gregory Brothers YouTube videos that they have found that they think might work in their format. And if the Gregory Brothers see something they think will work as a sort of a musical piece, they'll take the person's speech and run it through this machine that auto-tunes it. So, you know, it sort of sounds like it's sung and it has a kind of a musical background to it. And then they'll sort of chop it up so that certain key phrases in the Antoine Dawson video, there was one or two phrases that keep coming back. And in the I Love Cats, it's, you know, I love cats, I love every kind of cat, becomes a kind of a chorus. So, you know, in the end, you've got a song. And it's also a fun thing to watch. So it's a sort of a mashup of a video, like a music video, but a music video based on something that didn't begin as a music video. So repurposed. That's the difference.
Well, John Seabrook, it's been interesting. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to be here again.
Let's listen to I Love Cats.
This is my first attempt at a eHarmony video. I'm nervous, but I'm excited at the same time. So I'm just gonna start talking about what I like. I love cats. I love every kind of cat.
I just want to hug all of them, but I can't hug every cat. Can't hug every cat. So anyway, I am a cat lover and I love to run. I'm sorry I'm thinking about cats again. I really love cats. I'm thinking about cats again and again and again and again and again. I think about how many don't have a home and how I should have some. I think about how cute they are and how their ears and the whiskers and the nose.
John Seabrook's piece on YouTube is in the current edition of The New Yorker. You can find some favorite YouTube video pics of the Fresh Air staff on our website, freshair.npr.org.
A new era today in the growth of the Internet. For the first time, organizations can apply for an Internet address all their own. .com or .org can now be replaced by, say, .starbucks or .New York. The expansion was planned by the one organization empowered to regulate the global Internet. It's called ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. As NPR's Tom Gelton reports, debate over the new policy has highlighted one key question: who, if anyone, should control the Internet?
Anyone who wants their own Internet suffix, their own domain name, will have to pay $185,000 for it. This development could be costly, even for those who just want to keep someone else from grabbing their name. Not surprisingly, ICANN has been criticized for pushing the change, and in Congress, members have been eager to offer the ICANN leadership some free advice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that ICANN's proposed changes need to be closely scrutinized, and I thank the gentleman.
Mr. Chairman, I believe ICANN needs to take a step back, slow down, and reexamine this proposal. The Internet.
I think you folks should take to advice here and not charge so much here.
Democrats Ed Markey of Massachusetts and Doris Matsui of California, plus a Republican, Cliff Stearns of Florida. Unhappiness with ICANN on Capitol Hill is bipartisan. Some members of Congress actually wanted the Department of Commerce to order ICANN to delay the domain expansion. The Internet was a U.S. creation, and ICANN was chartered by the Commerce Department. But by urging the Commerce Department now to give ICANN orders, members of Congress may inadvertently aggravate another problem. Internationally, there is currently a big pushback over U.S. domination of the Internet and a growing move to diminish the U.S. role. Kieran McCarthy, an analyst of Internet governance issues, says some U.S. officials worry pressure on the Commerce Department to dictate ICANN policies could backfire.
He's making the Internet look exactly like the rest of the world fears that it is, which is a U.S.-controlled entity.
In fact, nearly half of all Internet users today are in Asia. ICANN CEO Rod Beckstrom this week said the domain expansion will reflect the way the Internet is destined to change in the coming years.
You're going to see more different languages in domain names, I would predict. And so it's going to look more like the world, and it's going to look less like one individual country. And I think that that's a good thing.
But ICANN's increasingly international focus may not be enough to satisfy governments that resent the U.S. role in Internet governance. Those complaints are likely to come to a head this December when the International Telecommunications Union, a UN agency, holds a meeting in Dubai to rewrite legally binding global treaties in such a way as to radically change how the Internet would be governed worldwide.
It's extremely serious. It's fundamental.
Kieran McCarthy.
Everyone knows that changes will be made at this UN meeting in December in Dubai. And now the effort is to limit the impact that those changes will have.
The move is led by China, Russia, and India, all of which, in one form or another, favor putting the Internet under the supervision of the United Nations. David Gross, who has represented the United States at other international telecommunications meetings, says UN supervision could jeopardize ICANN's current approach, under which the Internet is overseen by a variety of groups. It's called the multi-stakeholder principle.
Governments, including the U.S. government, but others as well, the private sector, technical groups, NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and others should all have a say in how the Internet should develop.
That's how ICANN works now. But if the Internet were brought under UN control, governments alone could control the Internet. Some would want to keep it free and open, but not all of them, Gross says.
Other governments, of course, would like to see increased governmental control as a way of suppressing the free flow of information or suppressing innovation and changes that the internet brings.
China and Russia in particular are proposing new restrictions on internet activity, and those governments are big movers behind next December's UN conference on the internet. They will be opposed by the United States. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
This year, more than 3,100 companies flocked to the Consumer Electronics Show to hawk their wares. Thousands of products are launched at the show, and many fail, possibly most. Lots of small companies established just for this show will not be back next year. But as NPR's Steve Henn reports, their hustle is infectious, and some of them become tech stars.
Before I came out to Vegas for this year's show, a friend of mine told me about this tiny little company that had a new way of waterproofing gadgets. It was this great little story no one else would have. But then my friend spaced, took ages to get back to me with the company's name. By the time I made my way into HZO's booth, this little company had become a media sensation.
Have you ever lost an iPhone in the commode?
I admit I have.
You have? Okay, yes. Well, here we go. Watch this. This is a product that may be coming out soon.
Good Morning America recorded that spot at 2:45 in the morning on Monday. It ran the day before the show even started.
It's fantastic for us. We've had such an outpouring of interest.
Those 22 seconds of TV time were like rocket fuel for Paul Clayton's little company. By Tuesday morning, every major electronics manufacturer was talking to him. By Thursday, a Google search for HZO and the Consumer Electronics Show turned up 199,000 hits.
CES is really a launching pad.
Jason Oxman's with the show's host, the Consumer Electronics Association. He says each year something like 20,000 new products debut at the show. 20,000. But with so many new products, not everything could be a hit. What is that?
PLEORB.
PLEORB. And how much do they cost?
$469.
$469 for a plastic dinosaur robot?
Well, actually, it's like a real pet with a poo-poo and wee-wee.
That's right, a real pet. Poo-poo and wee-wee not included.
Among those 20,000 products, there are a lot of them that aren't going to make it. There's no question about that.
Jason Oxman at the Consumer Electronics Association wouldn't answer my next question, but it's one of my favorites, so I asked Bill Bain out on the show floor instead.
So what's the worst thing you've seen?
Probably 8 million versions of iPhone 4 cases.
But there was this one guy who was undaunted. He's completely convinced that what the world really needs is just one more special iPhone case.
I launched a Kickstarter video yesterday. I'm David Barnett. I'm a philosophy professor at University of Colorado, and I invented a new cell phone case right here.
Barnett's business plan is to raise cash on the online site Kickstarter and then start manufacturing his special case. He spells it all out in this video.
And while I don't know much about making Kickstarter videos, I do like to dance. Hit it.
Barnett didn't even have a booth, but there he was, cruising up and down the aisles with a prototype in one hand and a pile of business cards in the other. And yes, he really is a philosophy professor. You know, it informs this work.
Prototype, rejection, start again. So it was the Hegelian cycle.
And if Barnett's little business doesn't pan out, he'll survive. He's got tenure. But actually, his case is pretty cool. Steve Henn, NPR News, Las Vegas.
With the Republican presidential candidates campaigning in South Carolina, we've been reporting on one town in that state, Greenville, where America's industrial past and future are side by side. What's going on at one company, Standard Motor Products, is emblematic of what's going on in manufacturing as a whole. As part of a story co-reported with The Atlantic magazine, Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money team reports on the future of manufacturing as seen through the eyes of workers.
Larry Sills runs Standard Motor Products, like his dad did, and so did his grandfather. They make replacement parts for car engines. He grew up with the company, and he has seen the workforce change over the years. A few decades ago, a lot of his workers had no high school diploma. Some of them were even illiterate.
We had a plant in Connecticut where we didn't realize it, but they were illiterate. And then when we switched to the next level, the next generation, we had to be able to read the instructions. To our astonishment, they couldn't do it.
But in today's factory, they don't just have to know how to read.
Yeah, we have a microscope, a height stand, snap gauges, ID gauges. We use bore mics, go-no-go plugs.
That's Ralph Young, the perfect model of the new factory worker. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of metals and microscopes, gauges and plugs. He works on the team that makes fuel injectors, which require precision engineering, performed by an automated machine run by a computer process known as CNC.
When I came here 20 years ago, we didn't have CNC equipment. It was more of the hammer and screwdriver fix to where now it's all finesse.
Now it's all finesse. That could be the motto of American manufacturing today. And not everyone has the finesse to run a CNC machine. Now, I can read. I've had some computer classes. I have a BA. But when I asked Ralph's boss, Tony Scalziti, if he would hire me and train me on the job, if I had enough education and skill, his answer surprised me.
No, of course not. The risk of having you be able to come up to speed with training would be a risk I wouldn't be willing to take.
What's the risk?
Well, like Ralph said, we could train you for 6 months and you don't get it.
To become like Ralph, I'd have to learn the machine's computer language. I'd have to learn the strengths of various metals and their resistance to various blades. But then there's something I don't think I'll ever be able to achieve. It's the ability that Ralph and other expert machine operators have, the ability to picture dozens of moving parts in their head. Half the people Tony has trained over the years just never were able to get that skill. And if you don't get that skill, a mistake on this machine can be catastrophic. All the work that's done here happens on a scale of microns. 1 micron is 400,000ths of an inch. A human hair, for example, is 70 microns thick. Here, you cannot be off by 1/10 the thickness of a human hair.
A 7 or 8 micron wrong adjustment in this machine costs us $25,000 workhead spindle. 2 seconds, we could lose $25,000.
In 2 seconds?
In 2 seconds.
That's why I wouldn't hire you.
Because you think I'd probably do that.
On accident.
Yeah.
It's not all Ralphs who work here. There are still remnants of the old, low-skilled assembly line. Madeline Maddie Parlier is more like the old style of worker. She does have a high school diploma, but no further education. And she works on a simple machine that seals the cap of a fuel injector onto the body. All she does is insert 2 parts and push a button. It requires no discretion, no judgment, no special knowledge. There's only 1 way to run it, the right way.
How long does it take to learn this?
It takes like not even 5 minutes because it does it for you. All you do is just put the piece in, push the clamps down, and push your finger.
There are a lot of things Ralph knows that Maddie wishes she knew. She wants to know how many microns thick the different parts are. She wants to know the computer language used on the machine she runs. She wants to know all the things that make Ralph's job prospects so much brighter than her own. And until she knows those things, her future is just not going to be certain at all. Maddie has a job I learned because of some simple math. A machine could easily replace her. A robotic arm could put the parts in and take them out, but it would cost around $100,000. Maddie makes a lot less than that, and for now, the math is in her favor. Now, let's say the price of a robotic arm goes down, or a factory in China learns how to make these parts for a lot less. Then Maddie's job would be at risk. Simple calculations like that have cost around 5 million factory workers their jobs over the last decade. Just because the calculation is simple doesn't mean the decision to lay off workers is easy. Larry Sills, CEO of Standard Motor Products.
It's gut-wrenching. And we try, because we are a family company. We're not a big Wall Street type company. We're a family company. We have a very strong loyalty to our people, and we think they feel the same back. So this is brutal.
So if the decision is so brutal, why does he do it in the first place? Why not just keep those workers on?
The decision is not made by us. The decision is made when the consumer walks into Walmart and there's 2 products on the shelf. And one is made in this country and one is made in China. And the one in China is 50% cheaper than the one that's made here. And they choose the one that's made in China. That's when the decision is made.
This is why Standard Motor Products has outsourced parts like electric relays or air conditioning compressors to factories in low-wage countries. Maddie knows all this. She knows she's not living in the old days. She worries about the technology or the low-wage worker abroad that could replace her. She knows that unless she learns some of the things that Ralph knows, she probably won't have a job this good for long. But she's a single mom with 2 kids.
I want to go back to school, but it's the time. If I want to go back, I have to go back on my time, and I don't have time. You know, when I get off work, I go pick my kids up, and that's it. My life revolves around my children.
What do you think education, like if you don't get education, let's just say for whatever reason you just never go back to school, what do you think that means for your future?
I'm always going to be where I am. I mean, to be honest.
The sad thing is, she'll only be where she is now if she's lucky. This is the true challenge of American manufacturing, of the American economy overall. How do we get the Maddies to become like the Ralphs? In the old days, Maddie would learn on the job. That's what Ralph did. He didn't have to pick between paying his bills and having a future. But now the gap between the skilled and the unskilled is so vast that often the only way to make the leap is by leaving work and getting some education. And that's just not financially feasible for a lot of Americans. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
This year, more than 3,100 companies flocked to the Consumer Electronics Show to hawk their wares. Thousands of products are launched at the show, and many fail, possibly most. Lots of small companies established just for this show will not be back next year. But as NPR's Steve Henn reports, their hustle is infectious, and some of them become tech stars.
Before I came out to Vegas for this year's show, a friend of mine told me about this tiny little company that had a new way of waterproofing gadgets. It was this great little story no one else would have. But then my friend spaced, took ages to get back to me with the company's name. By the time I made my way into HZO's booth, this little company had become a media sensation.
Have you ever lost an iPhone in the commode?
I admit I have.
You have? Okay,
yes.
Well, here we go. Watch this. This is a product that may be coming out soon.
Good Morning America recorded that spot at 2:45 in the morning on Monday. It ran the day before the show even started. It's fantastic for us. We've had such an outpouring of interest. Those 22 seconds of TV time were like rocket fuel for Paul Clayton's little company. By Tuesday morning, every major electronics manufacturer was talking to him. By Thursday, a Google search for HZO and the Consumer Electronics Show turned up 199,000 hits.
CES is really a launching pad.
Jason Oxman's with the show's host, the Consumer Electronics Association. He says each year something like 20,000 new products debut at the show. 20,000. But with so many new products, not everything could be a hit. What is that?
PLEORB.
PLEORB. And how much do they cost?
$469.
$469 for a plastic dinosaur robot?
Well, actually, it's like a real pet with Poo Poo and Wee Wee.
That's right, a real pet. Poo Poo and Wee Wee not included.
Among those 20,000 products, there are a lot of them that aren't going to make it. There's no question about that.
Jason Oxman at the Consumer Electronics Association wouldn't answer my next question, but it's one of my favorites, so I asked Bill Bain out on the show floor instead. So what's the worst thing you've seen?
Probably 8 million versions of iPhone 4 cases.
But there was this one guy who was undaunted. He's completely convinced that what the world really needs is just one more special iPhone case.
I launched a Kickstarter video yesterday. I'm David Barnett. I'm a philosophy professor at University of Colorado. And I invented a new cell phone case right here.
Barnett's business plan is to raise cash on the online site Kickstarter and then start manufacturing his special case. He spells it all out in this video.
And while I don't know much about making Kickstarter videos, I do like to dance. Hit it.
Barnett didn't even have a booth, but there he was, cruising up and down the aisles with a prototype in one hand and a pile of business cards in the other. And yes, he really is a philosophy professor. You know, it informs this work.
Prototype, rejection, start again, so it was the Hegelian cycle.
And if Barnett's little business doesn't pan out, he'll survive. He's got tenure. But actually, his case is pretty cool. Steve Henn, NPR News, Las Vegas.